VorpalNetwork.com.
This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again.
The Devious Book of Fumbles and Crits, and listeners like you. Thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store.
Hi, this is Wolfgang Bauer, author of Forge of War, Expedition to Demon Web Pits, and a whole lot of independent games you probably don't know. If you don't listen to The Tome, you're a sad, sorry man.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 168. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner.
And I'm Tracy Hurley, and in this episode, we will study game design in the courts of the Vile Fae and win the day with a band of Hild mercenaries as we talk to Wolfgang Bauer and Matt James about some of the prizes you can win in our new life contest, The Kobold's Guide to Game Design, Volume 3, Courts of the Shadow Fae, and Soldiers of Fortune from Open Design.
But before we send it all off to Tracy to talk to Wolfgang, I want to mention our first sponsor for the episode, Noble Knight, where you can find some great things, new and old, just like my pick of the episode. The Flip Mat Keep from Paizo Publishing. The mapping is all done for you, but you can also customize with your markers all you want. It's only $12 from Noble Knight, and it folds up into the size of a sheet of paper. Find the link in the show notes.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
Hi, Tracy here with Wolfgang Bauer, head kobold over at Kobold Quarterly and Open Design. Today we are going to talk a bit about the company, and in particular about two products, Kobold's Guide to Game Design Volume 3, Tools and Techniques, and Courts of the Shadow Fae, a 4th edition adventure for levels 12 to 15. So I guess we could start off with, could you tell us a little bit about yourself? I know you've been on the show.
Sure, I've been on the show before, but not everybody hears every episode, so yeah, sure. Well, I'm Wolfgang Bauer. I'm a game designer, I'm a game editor, and a game publisher. I got my start in the industry with Dungeon Magazine, and I worked in Lake Geneva for TSR about 4 years, working on Dragon Magazine and Dungeon Magazine, and writing Al-Kadim and good chunks of Planescape. Back then, and then I went to Wizards of the Coast for a little while. Probably the highlight there. Well, there's a highlight and a low light. The highlight is I published the Dark Matter campaign setting for the Alternity game, and the low light is I worked on a Magic the Gathering role playing game that was never published. So, you know, there were three versions of that game, and none of them were published. So it was a heartbreaker every time. It's not going to happen, I don't think. And now I run my own little shop, which is called Open Design. And basically anybody who wants to sign up can help me fund various adventures and source books and now a campaign world called Midgard. And people sign up and we talk about it on the message boards and I show them how I do that design work. It's been a lot of fun.
So basically you're talking with that about the patronage model.
Yes.
Do you want to talk a little bit more about how that works? I know some people are a little confused.
Sure. It's not all that confusing. It's kind of like a pre-order, right? You're buying into a product that doesn't exist yet. But it's a little bit cooler than a pre-order because you're buying into a product that doesn't exist yet. And then you get to see it being made and you can contribute to it, right? That's the open part of Open Design is you and, you know, 50 or 100 other people see every step of it, and often the patrons become co-authors and are paid and credited as game designers on these projects.
Yeah.
So it's a really different approach, right?
Okay.
You can play test it. You've done it, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, I should probably disclose at this point that I did just that. I signed up as a senior patron on The Lost City. I pitched an idea for one of the adventures, and I was accepted, and I got to work on it.
Directly with Logan Bonner, recently of Wizards of the Coast, right? I mean, so you're kind of working hand-in-hand with someone whose WotC experience with 4th edition was right there in the WotC building. So,
yeah,
I mean, you can probably tell people the good and the bad of that approach, but...
it's really interesting, because the thing is, I mean, you know, if somebody had just handed me the opportunity to do 12 pages, given my level of experience, I would have probably gone insane.
Uh-huh. But it's not like you're doing it all alone.
No, because you have the patrons there to help you. And, I mean, sure, sometimes people are going to disagree over what they think should and shouldn't be in there. But, I mean, that's part of the process, too, I think, is, you know, learning how to collaborate and how to work with other people. And then, you know, eventually you're going to have to make... You know, you can use polls. That's one way to do it. And then sometimes, you know, a designer does just have to say, you know.
Logan was great. He'd, you know, come down and say, this is what I think, and we're going that way because I'm the big chief on this project. And it was the same way for me on Courts of the Shadowfey, right? It's like, well, I have this idea about the Shadow Realm, and I have this idea about how to build an adventure that's, you know, more heavily tilted toward role play but still has a ton of combat, and then I wanted to introduce two whole new mechanics, right, around dueling and status.
Right.
And so we built brand new mechanics, did very traditional combat terrain encounter work, and then did some segments that's like, okay, this is a role-playing sequence, and I'm going to write it. And if the playtesters hate it, I'll rewrite it. But really, I want to do this one chunk my way.
Right.
It's a give and take, and the fun of it is that, yeah, you are working with other people. It's not sort of the lone genius somewhere in an attic eating ramen noodles and thinking, yeah, this is it. I got it. Right? And that's the popular idea of how game design happens, is somebody alone at a keyboard. And I don't think that always is the best way to go, especially when you're starting out. I learned, going back to Lake Geneva for a second, right? I mean, I learned how to do games editing and games design a little bit because I sold stuff to Dungeon Magazine before I ever worked for TSR. But then once I showed up there, it's like, well, I have all these other people who've been doing it, who wrote first and second edition products for years. I could just ask them.
Right.
And so, you know, the next best thing to actually being in the building with the WotC designers and doing game design is, well, being on the same message board and on the same email threads as WotC designers.
Right. That's been one of my harder things is, you know, trying to get that sort of feedback, you know, of this is working, this isn't. I mean, people like to be nice.
Well, most people, they try to spare your feelings, and that's bad because you never learn, right?
Right.
You know, of course your mom loves it, and of course your game group loves it because they're your players and they want those XP next week. but they're your friends, right? And so they're not really going to hurt your feelings and say, wow, that encounter just sucked. That was a bad idea. Kill it and start over. And they're just going to tell you the good news, and you're not going to get better. So, I mean, fiction writers pay... I was shocked. I mean, people will pay $500-$600 to go for a weekend with somebody who's a novelist and does a workshop on fiction and will read a chunk of your book and tell you what's wrong with it, right? And you'll sit in a fiction workshop workshopping the book. I can't believe it's a verb. and you know, that's like 72 hours you spend with other writers, struggling writers who are unpublished, professionals who can really help you based on their own experience. And with open design, it's like, well, you got a few months to hang out with people and learn what you're doing right and wrong and back it up with playtest or the strength of your argument or what have you.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's a pretty good deal. And it's the other thing that's great about it, though, is what comes out the other end tends to be higher quality. And this is why we keep getting nominated and winning awards. as smart as I am and as clever and handsome and devilishly sly as I am, right? Having 50 people look over any manuscript of mine is really humbling, because no matter how great I think it is and how I think, I was really on fire, it was hot, I was great, and I revised it, and it's perfect, I put it out there in front of 50 people, and they always hone in on, well, you know, this is the paragraph that sucks. Mm-hmm. And you probably ran into this.
Oh.
And yeah, and it's like, we're taking the dark side of the internet, right? The side that says, yeah, I read that and it sucked. And we're turning it to the light side, right? Where the human instinct is to critique everything and say what's wrong with it. And if we do that enough to encounters and game design, then, you know, at a certain point, people say, yeah, it doesn't suck as much. And then it's publishable.
Right. I spent probably, I think, over 2 weeks working on my pitch. And yeah. Then I got the Logan's short critique of the pitch. And it was something like, it's well organized, but what's the point?
Oh, and that sucks, doesn't it?
And I was like, but you know what? At the same time, it was like, finally, you know, I need it. That's what I needed. I need it because I couldn't understand otherwise. Like, until you've been through it, you can't understand it. And, you know, a lot of other people were like, oh, it's great. You know, it's a great pitch and everything. But nobody had said that. And as much as it sucked to hear it, I mean, it was yeah. Awesome. That's what I paid for. That's what I wanted out of it. It was crazy because I had only signed up to learn how to pitch.
Yeah.
And then all that other crazy stuff happened, which was great and awesome.
Well, and we should say, right? I mean, not everybody who pitches gets their pitch accepted, right? Everyone else on the project votes and says, these are the top three, or, you know, this is the best one. And there are people who pitch and don't go to that next stage that you did, which right. is write those 12 or 15 or 30 pages, your chunk of the book. So you were very fortunate. Yeah, the pitch got killed once, but then you came back on the second round or the third round. I don't remember.
I got mine in the first round, but...
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah. I think Logan waited till maybe after most of the votes have been cast.
Oh.
I don't know. I feel very fortunate to have gotten that far in the process, so...
Right, but I mean, I think just learning how to pitch by itself is extremely valuable.
Yeah.
I saw this all the time when I was editing... Dragon or Dungeon for that matter, right? And I know Steve Winter and Bart and all those guys who are working on the periodicals right now, they have the same problem, right? They get a pitch, and if it's like, I want to talk about whatever, Knightly Orders or the Raven Queen or something, but it's written so poorly that they have no confidence that the author can actually turn over a publishable manuscript,
right.
You know. They'll turn it down. They're like, well, it's a good idea, but this joker can't write that thing, and I know because they can't write 200 words to convince me.
Right.
Right? So your first audience as a designer is always convincing a publisher or an editor at Dragon or Cobalt Quarterly or somewhere to give you the shot to write the real thing.
Right.
I guess the art of the pitch is important. I guess, well, I wrote an essay on how to pitch, and some people find it helpful. It's in one of the Cobalt Guides to Game Design. I think it's volume 2. But, I mean, it boils down to don't be boring and don't bury the best part, right? Sell the sizzle. Don't sell the mechanics. Much as we love crunch in games... If you pitch me something that's crunch, 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 I'm going to say, great, somebody hire this man to do a design, but I can't run just stat blocks in Dragon, right? And I think we've seen that in the new editorial direction. It actually is pushing further in terms of flavor, world building, everything we call fluff.
Right.
I mean, yeah, you need both. Oh, all right, how to pitch. It's important. People should learn it, and they should practice and get better by pitching to Cobalt Quarterly first, because we're smaller and nicer. and we will actually respond to your query saying no, and here's why. Well, that's the one thing I don't like about the current Dragon editorial policy is you can pitch them, and they, if the answer is no, they just say that they don't respond, right?
Right. Yeah, it's definitely, I've heard of a lot of people complaining about the black hole and how...
I've seen it from the other side, right? I used to fill out form letters, like in the early 90s. We had a photocopied sheet, and I was the junior editor who was like, okay, go, Wolfgang. Go copy 50 more form letter rejection sheets, right? It's like, oh, God, it killed me. It's like, this poor guy, poor this heart. She really tried on this pitch, I could tell. Going to slap the form letter on, and it's going to go back with just that. And
right,
but the volume of material they must get.
Oh yeah,
there's really no choice. Some people want to argue with you too. You say sorry, not interested, and then they come back with, yeah, but what if? No, really, not interested. Bitch me something else. No, but I really want to write this. Write it for someone else. They just won't take no.
Right.
So.
Yeah, no, I've found you guys very easy to work with. I just haven't had as many awesome ideas lately.
You're loaded with them. They all go to your blog, though, right?
Yeah, I think that's one of the hard parts today. I mean, versus even a few years ago, the blogs make it kind of hard. Because like you said, totally. People have this idea and they want to write about it.
Sure, know? And it's like, well, I don't need anyone's permission to put it up on my blog. Of course, it's easy, right? I'm just going to write it. I'm excited about it. I'm going to post it and hope people care.
Right. And I mean, I'm getting to the point where I want more than that. Because I do want that, you know, criticism and
but
everything.
But blogs are a great training ground, right? If nobody cares and nobody comments, you know, well, I guess that wasn't as cool as I thought it was. Right.
Yeah.
And yeah, there is something to be said for with Cobalt or with Dragon or any sort of larger PDF publishers, all these guys. You know, if you pitch them and they accept it, you're going to go out. Well, A, you're going to get paid. And B, you're going to reach a much larger audience.
Right.
In most cases. I mean, there are some blogs that pull those kind of numbers, but it's a different sort of thing.
Talking about those awesome Cobalt guides to game design, I think I read 2 and 3. I haven't read all of 1 yet.
Okay.
So, and I think they really helped me a lot.
I'm always happy to hear that because they were a total fluke, right? They were never meant to happen. It goes back to the patronage model where, like, there's this fundraising stage early on where the game designers sitting around saying, oh gosh, I hope enough people sign up to support this project so we go ahead with it. And during that phase in the early projects, I would write these essays. And that's where Volume 1 and Volume 2 come from. It's just essays about game design. Here's what we're going to be doing soon, people, as soon as we get this annoying financial stuff out of the way. You know, there's a few weeks of got to do fundraising. It just feels like public television every time. It's so painful. I hate doing it, but, you know, I want to pay the artists and the writers and the cartographers and printers. So we do it. But that's where the essays come from. I was juggling and trying to amuse the patrons for a while. And I said, well, I've written 12 of these things. Let's put it in a book and, you know, send it out there. And then people have come back and said, you know, that's really good advice. I'm like, yeah, it only took me 20 years to learn it. So I'm happy to share it. The Volume 3 is the one that I did because I knew there were some tools and techniques of game design that are more than just, hey, me treading water or saying hi before a patron project, but like very specific, right? I got Colin McComb to talk about what he's learned about computer RPG design and comparing it to tabletop RPGs. Ed Greenwood talks about how to do plotting, making a dastardly plot. And Rob Hainsu, oh, bless him, he basically lays out the whole foundation of 4th edition Dungeons & Dragons. Like, here's my design philosophy. Here's how I go about thinking about design. And, you know, Monty Cook talks about game balance. It's my favorite of the 3 volumes, probably because I went out and asked designers whose work I really admire to to come and talk about it as well as just me. So I'm glad they're useful to people.
Yeah, I give them a lot of credit. I mean, I just started playing a little under 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I read them, and they helped me. Because I forget which one talks about it, but there's this whole issue of people who've been around for a while have a hard time or don't want to necessarily spend the time with new people to help them
learn. Yeah.
And
well, it's hard, right? You don't forget how hard it is at the beginning.
Right. And it's, I mean, for me, it's very hard because, you know, it's fourth edition, which is in some ways dramatically different than some of the older editions.
Oh, sure.
And on top of it, I'm really new. So people make a lot of assumptions about my background, but I'm an older, like I'm 32. So people make a lot of assumptions about my level of understanding. And
all right. The assumption is always you must have learned it in high school or college. Thus, you've been playing 10 years or something like that, right?
Right.
Yeah, because most people do pick it up at an earlier age. But even that, I mean, not everybody decides to start writing, right?
Right.
Beyond, here's my character sheet or here's my notes for the campaign. And it's a whole different skill set. I mean, I have notes from my Midgard campaign in a binder, and it's sort of embarrassingly thin and impenetrable to anybody but me. It's like, oh, look, a map. Oh, yeah, I printed this out. This is a monster from the monster generator. I photocopied this picture. And it's all stream of consciousness, and it totally helps me run my game, and it's organized for me, but I would never submit it anywhere.
Well, and that's what I did. I took those sorts of things, and that's what I put on my blog at the beginning. And some people said, hey, that sounds cool. Could you develop it more? You know, or write about it more. And that's what I would do. And that's how I started all of, like, everything that I do right now.
Well, that's what's so cool about the blogs, right, is you throw stuff out there, you see what sticks, and then you develop that more. Because the blog is like the campaign notes, right? It's a stream of consciousness. It's cool.
Yeah. And so, but and then being able to read something like, you know, the guides to game design really helped me then understand what you guys were talking about on Twitter and whatnot, so that I had a frame of reference so that I could start, you know, changing how I was framing my stuff or talking about my stuff so that we had more of a common language.
Yeah. Well, I think every game design community has this, and every game has this community and this jargon, right, and this vocabulary around it. And some are pretty deep, right? Like the guys on the Forge, if I'm familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? It's like they have jargon. They have theory. They have partisans of certain schools of thought. And that's cool, but that's probably not the place to start. and not everyone buys into their premises, right? If I'm just a dungeon master looking to write a slightly better adventure for my next Saturday night, then I don't need that little line advice.
Right.
And if I'm somebody who's trying to sell something to Dragon Magazine, then yeah, I might need all the help I can get. I don't know.
I definitely had some people write articles about me about how I wasn't using the terminology correctly. And I was just like, you know what? I'm a year and a half into this. You're going to have to give me a little time.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, you do it your own way too, right? I mean, Jonathan Tweed or Rob Hainsu or Monty Cook, I mean, they all have certain terms and certain assumptions that they make in their designs. And you can sort of see it over time. If you look at enough of an individual designer's games, you learn their style and their biases. And I'm sure I have them too. So even if somebody does share their secret sauce, you know, it's good to compare notes with what other people are doing.
Yeah. I think it was in, I may be wrong, I thought it was in the collaboration and design chapter where we talked about ego a little bit too.
Oh yeah, well, ego is such a huge issue for game designers, right? You have to have it to even start, because if you're too shy and too modest, then it's like, oh, nobody cares about my little game. I'm just going to be off here in my corner. I'm a beginner. And I mean, maybe you ran into some of that, maybe you different levels of ego, but at some point, if you really want to be a game designer, you have to say, oh, yeah, my stuff is awesome, and I will tell you why. And your stuff stinks, and let me tell you why, right?
Right.
And that's good and bad, without that level of ego, you never get started. But I think we've seen as fans and in the games community, you know, designers whose ego grows unchecked and they are convinced they can do no wrong ever. And it's...
No.
Yeah, I never know quite what to do with these people, right? Like, I'm glad you think that and you are possessed of great self-confidence, but you're wrong and you're kind of an ass.
Right.
So...
Yeah, it gets hard for me sometimes because I like to say what I enjoy, you know, and I try to make sure every time I say it that I say, and I know that may not be something you enjoy.
Right. Different play styles all over the place. Even with my home game, it's like, yeah, some people like the combat minis more. Some people really want to play the bard. And yeah. And you try to appeal to all those groups. I think, yeah, as a game designer, if your ego is so big, you think there's only one true way to play, you've lost part of your audience.
Right.
That's what it boils down to. So some flexibility is called for. And some sense of humility. And wow, patronage sure taught me humility in a hurry. But editors will do it too, right? You put something out there, you think it's great. Or bloggers, you get the comment stream on the thing that you love. It's like, eh, post was lame, did not read. Maybe your fans are kinder than that. But my impression is that gamers tend to shoot from the hip and, you know.
I had somebody one time, I think, do part of a blog post that essentially said I had the imagination of a small rock. That was awesome.
Yeah, love that. Thanks for sharing. But this is where ego helps, right? If you say, oh yeah, nobody does care, I'm a sad panda, then you don't write again. And if you say, screw that guy, my stuff is good, and, you know, if you have enough designer ego or right. blogger ego, you pick yourself up and you say, in my next post, I will tear this person a new one, or maybe that's not your style, maybe you'll just say, in this next post, I will provide further evidence for my point last week.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And blogs definitely are a good training ground, because, I mean, the first year... I felt like nobody knew who I was and what I was doing or anything like that. And then suddenly it all changed.
Right. It takes time to build a following. Takes time for the word to get out. So much time, right? Even when you're doing good work. I mean, like the first year of Cobalt Quarterly was me goofing around at a fanzine level. And I'll look at those issues now and I say, yeah, okay. There's a reason the word didn't get out immediately. But now it's slick and beautiful, and, you know, the people who show up to write and send me queries are quite impressive. So I'm really proud of how far it's come in 4 years.
Yeah, I really enjoy it.
It takes time, right? The blogs are the same way. No site gets there overnight. But building the audience for you as a blogger and you as a designer is... the other thing that happens when you land a gig at a high-profile site, right? You put something in with Critical Hits or Kobold, or you finally get a piece accepted in Dungeon, it raises your profile, even when you're already doing well.
You know, it's great.
Yeah. So, yeah, submit more articles, I think, is my secret message there. What else can I tell you about?
Do you want to talk about Courts of the Shadowfey a little bit?
I do. I really do. Man, did I have the ego going into that. I was like, you know, Gary Gygax talked about the Plane of Shadow a whole lot. And he teased and hinted, but it never really paid off because the modules he wrote in the Plane of Shadow were okay, but weren't what I wanted out of it, right? And I'm really looking forward to the 4th edition Heroes of the Shadowfell kind of material. But it didn't exist at the time, so I said, screw it, I got to write my own. And that's what Courts of the Shadowfey was. I've been talking about dark, shadowy fey in the Midgard setting and Zobek for a year or more, and it was time to kick it up with a Paragon-level adventure. I said, these are the guys. This is what I want to do. I think I can pull off something. And then the problem became, well, how the hell do you do that? There's nothing official on the Shadow Plane in 4th edition that really gets me everything I need. So I had to start from scratch, right? All the monsters in there are original. There's a ton of new material that players will never have seen before. And that all turned out really nicely because part of the goal was to throw players off kilter, right? By Paragon, they've got a lot of chops and a lot of powers, and they've been together for a while, and they've got teamwork down. And yet, going to another plane should be disorienting. Dealing with the Fae should always be disorienting. There's a bunch of demons in this adventure. That should never be easy, right? You should get the sense that it's raw, pure evil and will destroy you. So I tried to put all the flavor elements in such a way that the opening scenes are kind of creepy and disorienting and hard to figure out what's going on, which is fairly typical for an opening sequence, a first act, right? But then I had to move them out of the mortal world into the fairy realm, and there's a nice ritual and some investigation that does that. And then I wanted a big role-playing section. And I don't know why 4th edition gets the rap sometime that it's not role-playing heavy, right? It's like, it's not that hard. The skill system's there. All the tools are here, skill challenges for social things. It's all there. But I decided to make it even put in more incentive for role-playing by putting in a status system because it's a courtly adventure. And so, like, there's experience point as a track and levels as a track, but in a very simple, you can earn status points plus, and you can lose status points minus. And it's basically, what do the Shadow Fae think of you? Are you as big a badass as you think? And once it's explained to the players, oh yeah, here you are at the court. There's this thing called status. You want more of it. No, really, once you put a point-based mechanic and a simple ladder in front of people, the playtesters took to it like, oh, man, where can I get more of these status points? Like, well, they're mostly role-playing, and there's some dueling mechanic. Dueling! How do I do dueling? Like, okay, the playtesters are on board with this. And that was one of those eye-opening moments of design for that particular adventure was if we change the reward structure appropriately and give people experience, magic items, and status points for role-playing encounters, for the most part, they said, yeah, we did a lot of fighting, but the ones we will remember from that adventure were the role-playing encounters. So I'm pretty proud of the work on that one. It was extremely well-reviewed. It's sexy. It's horrific. and I would recommend it to anybody who's kind of looking for a Paragon-level adventure that is not a standard dungeon crawl by any stretch, but that is full of blood and horror.
Right. I totally agree with you about the status thing, too. I think it's something that people should pull out of something like this and put into campaigns if they really do want the characters to care what they're doing. And you can do it to lots of things, right? Like maybe you're
absolutely.
Maybe you're somewhere where killing wolves would be a bad thing, So, So if you kill a wolf, then you've decreased your status, and if you help them or let them go, maybe you keep it the same or increase. It doesn't really, but that matters. And as long as the players know it matters, then that suddenly changes how encounters work, right? Because now it can no longer just be about killing everything in the area.
Right. And I mean, you could turn it into a whole alternate experience system if you wanted, or you could just make it sort of a nice side thing where the players who grub for status points, right? Who are like, I want every status point I can get out of this adventure, are the ones who get the spotlight every time it's a social encounter or a role-playing encounter, because everybody goes, ooh, who just walked in the door, right? The NPCs all, hush, it's him.
Right.
And some players really enjoy that limelight, and other players are like, I'm playing the barbarian. Screw this.
Yeah, I mean, there are totally players who are always like, when's the next combat? And then there are other people who are like, can we get this combat over with so we can get back to, you know, role playing?
Right. And the thing that surprised me, right. The thing that surprised me was the low status players. Some of them got a kick out of being like the boorish grunting, I'm scratching myself barbarian.
Oh yeah.
While everyone around them is like trying to get a suck up to the Shadow Fae. It's like, no, not me. You bunch of wussies. And we're having fun playing against that courtly type, right?
Right.
It's a role-playing opportunity either way.
Oh, totally.
So yeah, I think I'm going to use status rules again. I used them actually in a very brief two-session campaign I ran for Empire of the Petal Throne, a role-playing game from the 70s. Original D&D was like 1974. Empire of the Petal Throne was 1975. I've never run it. I've owned it for 20 years or more. And I threw a status system on it where I said, okay, you know, roll your starting status, and forced people to sit at the table. Like, you know, high status players get to sit near the DM, slaves sit at the far end and fetch drinks, right? Because it's a slaving empire campaign setting. So they're really – it was tons of fun, right? And the casualty count was high, and everybody was like, all right, I've got strength and dexterity, and ooh, what's my status? So it was fun to play with for a little while. I don't think I'd put it in every game, but it was a nice change of pace.
That reminds me a little of Animal House. Apparently, they made them sit separately. Belushi made them sit separately all the time, so they really hated each other. The two.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I mean, those sorts of things work, right?
Right.
You can have a lot of fun with, us against them, and in groups and out groups with your players. Not every group is going to get into that. The more indie role players, I think that's all they do. But for a more meat and potatoes D&D group, to me, it feels like, oh yeah, we're going to have a change of pace now. We did the big dungeon, and now we're going to, you know, do a more role playing heavy section.
Right. Well, and I think it also ties back into something that I think maybe not everybody knew, or some people have forgotten about. The fact that the players are both the players in the game, but they're also the audience for the story that's going on. And sometimes
if they're not amused, yes, I can't remember. I think maybe, where did I hear this? Anyway, my theory is that game designers need to give dungeon masters the opportunity to be a big ham and entertain their players, right? Mm-hmm. Give them tools to be amusing with. And give players lots of freedom of action to be the entertaining guy at the table. If you're thinking about design not just numerically, but as what is the social experience at the table going to be like for this encounter, then you're sort of one step ahead of the pure number-crunching design. I think, especially with the tools we have for 4th edition D&D, it's pretty easy to build a balanced encounter numerically. Mm-hmm. It's harder to build a balanced encounter socially, where the combat monster, the optimizer, and the social engineer and the, you know, historian gamer are all satisfied.
Right. Yeah, I've been thinking that a lot lately, that it, like you said, it's really easy to build the combat encounters, and so I think the DMs have been going to that a lot more, because that's the easy part. That's the toolkit that's complete. But the part where trying to figure out how to make social encounters interesting to all those groups in a way that's consistent, I feel is missing a lot. And
right, and it's like, well, if you go to the thing that's easy and that's the only note or the only tool in your toolkit, eventually that gets old.
Right.
Right? If you play every week and it's combat, it's like, oh man, our DM doesn't have any range, right? Where's the interesting chase mechanic? Where's the prison sequence where we got to bribe the guards? Where's the anything that? And I think skill challenges pick up a lot of this ground, but not all of it. They're not the perfect tool for everything.
Right. And when I wrote for Critical Hits, I wrote a column about Robin Law's book. Hit points. And originally, if you looked at the original monsters, they pretty pretty much most of them hit heavy pretty early, so you had that immediate, like, oh my god, we're going to die, and then it leveled off. But now you see them switch more towards monsters that do damage, particularly with solos, after they're bloodied, because that way you can now do it at the end. It's like, oh, you know, we're hitting, we're getting them bloodied, and oh, crap. Now things get interesting.
But that makes so much sense in, like, in terms of a dramatic arc, right?
Right.
This is why people complain about grind. It's not that the end of a combat is boring. There's still hit points and there's still tactical options and resource management. All of that's still there. It's just that dramatically speaking, you don't have a lot of choices and a sense of danger at the end because you already know what the monster can do. And that's why the whole thing about when creatures are bloodied, they become more interesting, is such a beautiful solution.
Right. And I think particularly where, you know, some ways you might have done that in the past would be to introduce a trap or something like that. But in 4th edition, so many of the traps are easily, you know, either countermeasures or the players can just avoid them because we've been told not to put that many in, that they become almost useless. And I think that's why we don't see as many DMs using them. At least it seems useless. It's not necessarily that they are useless, but...
Well, I think they have a limited span of places where they're really helpful, right?
Right.
And the players find them less interesting, and I find them less interesting because they are... how to put this? They're unthinking, unfeeling opponents whom you cannot, you know...
Right.
You cannot lord it over them. Can't say... Puny kobolds, fear my wrath, right? I mean, it's hard to strut in front of a trap and say, yeah, we kicked your ass.
I totally got past that ice without falling. Take that.
Take that, stupid ice. I'm like, yeah, that's not that satisfying.
No.
Whereas, you know, we kicked your butt, we kicked your chieftain's butt, and we kicked your bugbear's butt. Oh, yeah, all right.
And now we're going to interrogate you.
Now we're going to interrogate you, so tell us where the treasure is. Oh, okay, I can see where the drama's going there. That's going to be fun. The DM should be chewing all over the scenery going with that. Yeah, so I agree. Traps have a limited usefulness. But that doesn't mean we can't make encounters with multiple layers and other ways to do it. Like, I don't know, the whole dueling thing. And I know we've been running along here, but the whole dueling thing is, you know, you're only going to fight till first blood, or you're only going to fight till somebody's knocked down. Nobody's going to die. But somebody's going to walk away a loser and less in the eyes of the audience that saw them lose.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I guess there are some stakes here, especially when it's, the Black Prince is watching you duel.
Right.
And you're up against the best swordsman at the court. Oh, shit, don't blow this. Right?
Totally.
And the nice thing about the dueling system is I caught a lot of flack from patrons early saying, yeah, but you're putting the spotlight totally on one player, right? And the rest of the party needs to be able to cheat and help them, and it needs to be a team effort. I'm like, all right, duels aren't team efforts. So let's find another solution. And the solution was they are over very fast, right?
Right.
There's build-up, a challenge. It's like, 2 rounds of combat and it's over. So one player with 2 rounds of combat, that's it's not taking away so much time in the game session that the rest of the party feels ripped off. Like, you know, you spend all your time talking to Mary and everybody else was bored. So that worked remarkably well. And I think we'll continue to use that in other environments once in a while. Yeah, so anyway, there's a little bit about what worked and didn't work in Courts of the Shadow Fae, and I've enjoyed it tremendously, and I'm going to see how much pressure there is to write a sequel. It's part two of a sort of 4th edition sequence from Open Design, and part three would be an epic level adventure, of which there are not so many.
But yeah, true, there aren't. And there's not a lot of support for epic either, which would be nice to get some.
Yeah, it would be like low epic, not high epic, because I don't know how many groups are actually playing at 29th level. But yeah, it might be fun. And Open Design tends to take those niche areas where it's like, is WotC really going to do a ton of epic support? Probably not. So we might take a shot at Epic as our next project. I don't know yet.
Neat.
Yeah.
Well, I did get one question from Twitter for you.
Okay. Sure.
I think I know the answer, but I'd rather have you answer it. And the question was, the guy wants to know if he has to do the whole sponsor thing in order to get the product at the end. He feels a little intimidated by OpenDesign. And I think in the past it used to be...
Oh, yeah. You used to have to be a patron to get the product at the end, but I don't... You know, we've abandoned that after about a year or so. All of these things that I'm talking about, like Courts of the Shadow Fae is available to the public now. And you don't have to be involved as a patron at all if you don't want to. You just pick it up on RPG Now or at your local hobby shop, or you go to the Kobold Quarterly store, and we'll send it to you, print or PDF, whatever you want. And you can skip the whole, you know, talk to the designer, watch behind the scenes thing, and just get the book at the end.
Right.
Yeah. It's not for everyone. And honestly, you're paying a little more to be a patron than you would to just buy the book at the end. And basically you're paying for somebody's time and attention and feedback and the chance to do it yourself and play test it and point out all the places where I'm wrong before publication and say this whole sequence sucks, fix it. So instead of being like annoyed with a product after it's printed, you can be annoyed with the product while there's still hope of fixing it.
Yeah.
and get a better book out of it. There's no requirement to sign up for that level of commitment.
I know. I pretty much rewrote my first draft within the week before it was due because of patrons commenting about that they'd rather see this, and that changed like a whole mess of other stuff, so I just rewrote like almost everything the week before.
Yeah. I have to say, writing for OpenDesign, I'd budget more time than writing for like something where there are no patrons watching me and critiquing, because I know they're going to come up with great ideas that I really want to include, and because I know they're going to catch me if I try to take a shortcut or if I had a bad night and I just, you know, the text kind of stunk. So yeah, there's more work on it and it's better stuff. But hey, good on you for rewriting the whole thing.
That's why I was getting nervous, and I was telling people, I was like, I am so scared. But it worked out in the end.
It did. The editor's done with it. I think the project you worked on is called The Lost City. It will be shipping in April, and I think it's available for a pre-order now through KoboldQuarterly.com. So if people want to check it out, it turned out pretty well. I haven't run it yet, so I can't swear to it, but it's on my list of, I'm going to run that.
Oh, sweet.
So.
Yeah, I can't wait to see what the editors did. That's going to be fun.
The editor, I think, has done good work with it. And likewise, maps, art, it's all starting to come together, but we'll see it in April.
Yeah, totally.
All right.
So I want to thank you for coming on and talking about OpenDesign.
Oh, my pleasure.
And also for providing some copies of the books that we talked about in Soldiers of Fortune for our contest.
Oh, sure. I hope somebody wins those and enjoys them and posts a review.
Great. Thanks.
All right. Have a good night.
And now before we go on to Jeff and Matt James, let's take a quick break to talk about a brand new sponsor for the Vorpal Network, the Devious Book of Fumbles and Crits from Unknown Tome. This book gives you a whole new way to add some crazy fun to your 4E game with charts of critical hit effects and critical fumbles. Try your luck. Check out the link in the show notes.
The Devious Book of Fumbles and Crits from Unknown Tome Publishing. A 4th edition D&D supplement for all levels, featuring 63 new unique treasures, including 6 item sets and 28 new hazards and terrain powers. The Devious Book of Fumbles and Crits will have you critting and fumbling your way into D&D gold. Visit our website to pick up this product in print or as a PDF.
I am here with Matt James, author of Soldiers of Fortune, published by Kobold Quarterly or Open Design, or how do they do that these days?
Well, the parent organization is Open Design, and one of their products is Kobold Quarterly.
And is another one of their products Soldiers of Fortune? So you're published by Open Design?
Yes, I would be, I guess, officially. I mean, it's published by Open Design, correct.
Right on. So let's talk a little bit about Soldiers of Fortune. What is it?
It's a book.
Oh, cool. Well, that's good enough. Moving on.
All right. Thanks for the interview. No, Soldiers of Fortune is a source book that provides new and interesting options for anyone who plays 4th edition, but also serves as a great additional content providing product for those who are interested in the Midgard campaign. World that's currently under development and design. But furthermore, what makes this truly unique is even if you don't care about Midgard and or you don't care about 4th edition Dungeons & Dragons, you can still use the a good portion of the content within this book for any game that you run as it relates to like military campaigns or mercenaries or soldierly topics. So it's I'm very happy with the way that it turned out.
So let's talk about that a second. Part of what you're saying then is that the fluff of the book would include a lot of just sort of the mechanics of how mercenaries and units of soldiers and that kind of stuff work.
Yeah, I mean, there's sections that describe the motivations on why people go to war, and you know, some of the principles of warfare and the tenets of warfare, which I mentioned in the book, are heavily influenced by the works of Sun Tzu and his Art of War that his disciples wrote. And so, yeah, that's very much applicable to any kind of campaign game system or anything where you're going to have combat or warfare. So, you know, there's a lot of value for just about anybody who's just interested in that kind of stuff.
And so this is pretty universal stuff. You could apply it to a fantasy setting as much as you could apply it to a modern setting, or is it specifically geared towards fantasy?
I mean, as you read the book, the prose is definitely geared towards fantasy, but the principles of warfare and why people go to war and those kinds of sections they come from the real world. They're influenced by my own understanding and studies of warfare and the politics involved and things such as that. So, yeah, very much applicable to the real world, and people can definitely have that parallel into any number of type of games.
Okay, so you mentioned that this is all coming out of your studies of warfare and your experiences with warfare. I suppose we should talk about your credentials in that area. You know, where do you get off telling us how soldiers work or how warfare functions?
Well, you see, I watch a lot of TV, so
A-team.
No,
A-team, right?
Yeah. I served in the United States Army from August 2003 until June of 2006, which doesn't sound like a whole terrible amount of time, but during that time, I served in as a paratrooper in the United States Army. I deployed to Iraq in November of 2004, and was subsequently injured during combat operations in May of 2005, after, you know, dozens upon dozens of various convoy missions and stuff. But that alone doesn't necessarily gear you towards, you know, necessarily understanding a higher level of combat or war. And don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting that I am in some way some great war philosopher or even a highly skilled or trained strategic command type, but I also attended school at American Military University, and as just kind of like a hobby, I consider myself a student of these types of topics. So it was really, really great when Wolfgang found me. I think Wolfgang actually found me on LinkedIn, that website where, you know, you can network with people, and he saw my credentials and he actually reached out to me in the late summer of 2009 and asked if I would be interested in designing a book for him and relating to something military. and we finally settled on the idea of Soldiers of Fortune. And and what I'm getting at is, because of my personal interest in these types of topics, I mean, it was just a great opportunity and something that would play off of two things that very much interest me. So that's kind of the quick answer, even though that was took me probably 5 minutes to describe.
I think both myself and our audience here knows you well enough, because you've been on enough, that we understand what a quick answer from Matt James is really like. Good. So you have probably more experience and more expertise in the area of warfare than most of the gaming community, although there, as I understand it, there's a sizable contingent of gamers in the military as well.
Yeah, which I think surprises a bunch of people that, you know, they don't necessarily associate role-playing with, you know, soldierly type stuff. I think there's misconceptions on both ends about the demeanor and stuff of either segment. But yeah, there are a ton of role players in the military. And I mean, I've got photographs of, you know, a couple shelves full of role playing books that I was able to coax someone into shipping to me while I was in Iraq. So it was awesome, you know, having, you know, you get off of a mission from real world combat to go and you want to relax. And how do you relax? Well, you go back to combat, but in a fantasy setting. So, yeah, that's pretty interesting.
Good. So you mentioned earlier that this book, it sounds like, is largely set in the Midgard setting.
Yes, it is set on the world of Midgard, which is, for those familiar with Zobek, the free city, that Zobek resides is one of the cities within this greater world.
Okay, and how does it work when you're designing a book set in Midgard when Midgard hasn't been written yet? Were there challenges with that?
Yes and no. Some of the other books that came out that Wolfgang had already published had some tidbits, and there was a good foundation of information found within the Zobek source book as well. And you know, communicating with Wolfgang and the editors and stuff, I was able to expand upon some of the areas in the world. And again, one of the coolest things is, you know, some areas that were previously undetailed, I got to at least get something started in those areas. So I found it less challenging and very rewarding.
So you got to actually help solidify what was in Midgard before Midgard became an open design patronage project.
Yeah, it was totally, totally cool.
So now they have to fit to your mold because you were there first.
Yeah.
Very cool. And now how dependent, you know, how much of what's written in the book is set in that setting? Could I incorporate this book into my Forgotten Realms campaign or into a Dark Sun campaign?
Yeah, one of the things that I wanted, one of the design philosophies going into this was to ensure that this content could be easily transferred anywhere that the readership wanted to take it. So, there's nothing in there that is so ingrained and specific to the Midgard campaign setting that you couldn't grab it and, you know, take it anywhere you want.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the crunch in the book. It's not all fluff, I assume. There's some mechanics in there.
No, yeah. There's a good portion towards the back of the book, which is a lot of crunch for fourth edition.
What kind of crunch are we talking about?
Well, there's a lot of new powers, and these powers. I originally started out designing these powers for specific classes, and then I decided to go back and rework them and make them very generic, so that instead of playing off of a class, they play off of primary abilities, so that any class can look at them and decide if it's something that they want to use to augment their existing, you know, structure. I also designed the mercenary theme, which for those of you who are familiar with Dark Sun, is a template that you can kind of apply to an existing character that helps you you know, kind of further develop them and take them down the path that you want. I included a bunch of new rituals and like the equivalent of like the martial disciplines, which are very cool that you can, you know, any character can kind of pick up. What else did I create? Magic items. There's four new Paragon paths in there. Of course, one of them being Soldier of Fortune. But those are, you know, they cover a good span of different power sources. So, you know, there's definitely something for everyone in there.
So it sounds like it's largely designed to be accessible to any player. So that because theoretically any character of any source or bent or role or whatever could be a soldier of fortune, and you're trying to provide the mechanics to help them, the mechanics to support that kind of a character.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I first started designing this, I was pretty specific, and then I wanted to back off and ensure that as many people as possible could enjoy this. Now, due to one reason or another, I mean, I couldn't include every specific power source, but, you know, with minimal tweaking, anybody should be able to jump right in and do what they need to do with these with the content that's as presented.
And it's interesting to hear that you included a theme, because themes are still fairly new. Wizards has been pretty slow in putting out new themes after the popularity of themes in Dark Sun.
Right.
Is that just sort of a function of there's a quicker turnaround on these kinds of projects, so you're able to develop new themes before Wizards is, or how did that work?
Well, actually,
did you have some secret insight ahead of time?
No. And if I did, I wouldn't be able to act on it.
Sure.
But no, I learned with everybody else when Dark Sun came out how awesome themes were, and I rushed to Wolfgang and said, I want to design a mercenary theme, and I explained to him why it would work and why it would be awesome, and he was able to get it into Soldiers of Fortune before its final publication. Now, you know, both companies are obviously very different, and they have a very different production schedule based on so many different things that I couldn't even talk about it on one podcast. So for the smaller publishers, when compared to a large publisher, it's much easier to get those kinds of things out much quicker.
Right. Absolutely. And there's an advantage to be had there. Good. So you mentioned a lot of crunch and a lot of things in there for players.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm sitting at my table, I spend a lot of my time DMing. What's in there for me?
Well, like I said, a good portion of, especially in the beginning of the book, gives you a lot of reasons for why you're going to go to war. It provides a lot of story hooks that DMs can use to kind of, get their players to go on these various types of things. There's a lot of suggestions for quests. I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I don't have the book in front of me, but yes, I wanted to ensure that I gave a lot of support to the Dungeon Master. There's also a kind of mini adventure that's within this book. And as much as it serves as an adventure that a DM can just kind of plug in, it also kind of, it's almost like a teaching tool where there's a lot of suggestions within the text of that adventure on things that you can do, kind of alternate rules and suggestions for how to give a specific feel. I know a lot of people, I've been getting a lot of good feedback, surprisingly, about a skill combat, which it's really hard to kind of describe, but it's kind of like a meta combat, where you still have a map, but the players can still use their powers and abilities and such as that. But there's also, you know, the combat's heavily influenced by the use of skills as well. I'm not doing it justice merely by talking about it, but that means you should just go out and buy a copy of Soldiers of Fortune, KoboldQuarterly.com.
Or win it in our contest.
Exactly. And, another cool thing that I merely scratched the surface of is the use of siege equipment within the structural foundation of the fourth edition game system rules. And if consumers or players, DMs especially, are interested in trying to integrate, you know, ballistas or trebuchets or even cannons, you can find that some great rules for that within this book. And I don't know that I'm going to have the time to be able to do it for the next edition of Cobalt Quarterly, but I'm going to try to get a piece to Wolfgang that will be in the print magazine that will expand upon and extrapolate more on this kind of siege warfare.
So now you're talking about siege engines and heavy skill use in combats and that kind of stuff. You haven't quite developed it to the point of creating fourth edition, battle simulations yet, have you? We're not up to battle system or anything yet.
No, we're not. This definitely, I foresee this being a good motivator, meaning I see maybe other designers or other will-be designers out there being inspired by what I put in this book and maybe coming up with a way to come up with some sort of expanded system for it. So,
very cool. It sounds like then you're moving along the right direction, and who knows, maybe in a year or so we'll be hearing about Soldiers of Fortune 2, Battle System 2.0, huh?
That would be awesome, yeah.
Very cool. Any last-minute things or any last things you want to talk about or mention that we didn't touch on that people should know about this book?
The price point is awesome. Wolfgang is selling it, I believe, as a PDF for $9.95, which you can pick up on, like, you know, any of the like drive-through RPG or even directly on KobaQuarterly.com. And the print copy is going for, I believe, for like $18, which is a really good price for any book like this. And for collectors out there, I personally like having the physical copy. So, yeah, it's going to be awesome. And I believe there's going to be an event that's going to happen at Syndicon, which is the DC area's premier kind of gaming convention that started up like a year or two ago. And I think we're going to do something big there. So if you're in the DC area or want to bring your family up and check out the monuments and then also catch a cool gaming convention, go to syndicon.net, which is syndicon.net.
Very cool. And I also hear that if you own a copy of Soldiers of Fortune, it will dramatically increase your luck with the ladies and help you lose weight and grow hair.
Well, just so you know, I lost since the book came out, and this is the God honest truth. Since this book has come out February 14th, I've lost like 9 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
My wife's been hitting on me a lot more, and I won $20 on a scratch off lottery ticket. So
there you go.
It's insane what this book can do for you. It's nuts.
Since I first heard about this book, I've gotten my wife pregnant and lost 15 pounds.
Exactly. So, see what I'm talking about?
Just by hearing about it, my life has dramatically improved, right?
Congratulations.
Well, that's what the contest is all about, celebrating anyway, right?
Exactly.
That's why we're calling it the New Life Contest.
If you want to become I'm a proud new father and lose lots of weight. And, I know we're talking about it from one end, but I know that some of the ladies who have been picking up the book have noticed many, many, augments as well.
Well, that's good.
Yes.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on, and thanks for talking to us about Soldiers of Fortune. And everybody can make sure to enter the contest to win. And we'll talk to you later, Matt.
All right, thanks, guys. We'll see you later.
Well, that's episode 168. I want to thank Wolfgang Bauer and Matt James for joining us in this episode, as well as our sponsors, Noble Knight Games and The Unknown Tome.
Email us at thetomeshow@gmail.com or visit the forums at gamershavenpodcast.com and call the Tomes Biz Line at 919-BIZ-TOME with your thoughts, questions, or comments for upcoming episodes.
This month, you should call the Tomes Biz line. That's 919-BIZTOME. And let us know ways that someone might be successful at adding puzzles to their game. Or maybe share a story of a particular puzzle that you enjoyed in your game. And you can swing by the forums and let us know about your experiences with evil PCs. And you do these two things, you will be entered for the month of March to win our contest, where you can win prizes like the ones that we discussed on this episode from Open Design, as well as our other great sponsors like Noble Knight Games, Aaliyah Tools, Sly Flourish, and many, many more.
And don't forget to consider checking out the Tomes Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds and it helps keep us on the air. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com.
This has been episode 168. A designer, an elf, and a merc walk into a bar with our Open Design prize discussion here on
The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome.
I'm on the wall.